Hi, this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 114 of Art for Your Ear. Today's episode is sponsored by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. You can visit them at saatchiart.com. My guest today is actually an artist who has been featured on Saatchi a whole bunch of times. Yep, I am talking to Lee Boyd, an artist based in Northern Ireland. I wrote about his Manimal series a couple of years ago, and yes, that would be a gorgeous drawing series of people with animal heads. In fact, I was lucky enough to have Lee draw me. You might have seen it on my Instagram feed a few months ago. He emailed and asked if he could use a photo that I posted of my trip to Venice as a base for a new piece. Of course, I said yes. Well, he turned me into a panther. So awesome. Anyway, we've never actually talked. We've just emailed. So today is the day. Here we go, calling Lee in Ireland. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Danielle. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Really good.
This is really good to talk to you. Pardon?
Really good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. This is very exciting. You're in Northern Ireland, right?
That's right, yeah. Just south of Belfast in a place called Bangor.
Oh, you have a good accent.
Well, yeah, my accent's not originally from here.
No, you sound
it's from
English.
The northeast. I am, yes. Ah. I'm originally from the northeast, but my dad's side of the family's from here, so I've been backwards and forwards since I was born.
Oh, okay.
So my journey, I kind of left the northeast when I was about 18 and came here to go to university.
Ah.
And I kind of bounced back to England for a little while and then come back here. So, yeah, this is home, definitely.
Oh,
home.
Nice. So you've got a lovely mixed-up accent.
Yes, very strange. I'll speak really slowly so everybody can understand.
No, you sound great.
I was subtitles.
I was a little bit nervous. I was like, uh-oh, am I going to be able to understand him? But no, this is so great because people are going to recognize your work. I wrote about you. Do you remember when I first wrote about the Manimal series?
Yeah, it was for Easter, and I remember it was about two years ago?
Yeah, maybe. Two and a half years ago. That seems crazy.
Yeah.
And then when I went to Venice this summer, I posted a picture of me on one of the bridges because you have to because it's Venice.
Yeah.
And you reached out and said, can I use that as a starting point? And it's the coolest. I could not believe what you came back with.
Glad you liked it.
So
it's always a gamble.
is that a panther? Jaguar?
It is, yeah. It's a black panther.
Yeah, that's...
I wanted to do something, playing with the idea of the curious cat.
Yeah.
But I thought you're a little bit more stronger than just a normal cat. You really do search and hunt out your artistic prey, if you like. So that's why I kind of went for the more panther than a soft pussycat.
Well, I could not believe it. I mean, you are such a talented artist to begin with, and then to see my photo and then to have your, you know, the curious cat thing in there too. I was just like, I have to admit, I shed a little tear.
Oh, well, thank you. But
yeah.
I thought it was a great photograph. You know, it just captured, because I've never been to Venice, but it just captured that, like a little scene of Venice that I thought, oh, yeah, that's such a sort of classic.
Yeah,
it was
iconic.
Nice, lovely pose. kind of reminded me of that 1940s style, kind of just, you know, walking along a little bridge in Venice. I thought, that is such a great photograph.
Well, you know,
so thank you for saying yes.
Well, thank you for doing it. And I especially brought that dress with me because I thought that's a very Venice in the 40s, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it was so hot when we were there, like so hot. That photo was taken at 7:30 in the morning. I said to my friend,
wow,
quick, take it before I sweat through this dress, because you could only walk about 4 or 5 steps before like you were drenched, like you could see the wetness through your clothes. So I was like, quick, I still look cute. Snap. And then it was just like a hot mess after that. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Plenty of ice cream and coffee will sort that out.
Oh, it certainly did. Watermelon gelato was my savior.
Oh, nice.
For sure. But no, it was so cool. And you know, I do love that photo and it captures my time there. And then to have you do an art piece on top of it, it just like made my year. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Thank you for saying yes.
Okay, let's rewind, because now I always start the podcast with asking what people were like as kids. So
yeah.
Were you drawing crazy things? Because I know you didn't go to school for drawing. So what were you doing back when you were little? Were you making art?
I was one of those really annoying kids that would run around the house saying, what can I draw? What can I draw? My poor old mum, God bless her, she would just like point at things and go, a teapot or television, flower pot, cat, you know, just random stuff. And I would, you know, scribble these things out and go, look what I've done. She'd go, great, lovely, put it in the fridge and that type of thing. But yeah, I remember, you know, playing with all my pencils all over the floor. And I've actually got, I've still got it. It's a green pencil lead stuck in my knee. Which is still, I've got a green dot. It's like a tattoo that I got when I was about four. but I had my pencils all over the floor and I was sharpening them all, making sure they were all right. A bit OCD as 4 year olds. I'm not like that now. And I was reaching forward to get another pencil and this pencil stuck in my leg. And I remember sort of having to yank it out. And back then it wasn't a case of you go to the doctors for absolutely everything. It was just like, give it a rub, it'll be all right.
Yeah.
And I've still got this green dot in my right leg. Just above my knee.
Oh my gosh, I love it. It's the mark of an artist. That's how you know.
Yeah, I think I was infected from that point.
Yeah, literally, probably.
But, yeah, literally.
Oh my gosh, that is so cool. Okay, so yes, you were an artsy kid. That answers that question for sure. And yeah. But you went to school for ceramics, right?
I did, yeah.
Was that your plan, going to art school with ceramics, or did you sort of find that once you got there?
No, I think it was a lack of confidence in school and going through the education system. I loved art. It was one of my favourite subjects. I used to go to, at lunchtime, go and sit in the art room and just tinker on with my artwork and, you know. And when it came to choosing what you wanted to do, I remember going to the careers advisor and they go, what do you want to do? And I thought, well, my route out of that stage when I was about 16, 17 was my art or join the army. Oh. And that's what I had down. I had, well, what, you know, what job could I do if I was an artist? And there was a lot of about graphic design. It was sort of the 80s and, oh, I'll be a graphic designer. So I had graphic designer or join the army. And it was just a diametrically opposed career choices.
Yeah.
That my careers advisor just kind of looked at me and went, what do you want to do? What do you really like doing? I went, I really like art. And she went, why don't you follow that? So I remember going back and having a conversation with my dad. And he said, well, can you get a job doing that? I was like, yeah, I think so. And he went, well, okay, do that then. So that's what I did. I went and did an art foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And the art foundation here, or back in the day in the 80s, it was 89, was great because you had the wealth of different media to play with. And you got to be introduced to things that you'd never got a chance to get introduced to during school. They were a little bit more in depth. But I had no confidence. And I remember wanting to be a fine artist and looking at all the people in the fine art department thinking, I'm just not cool enough.
Aww.
I'm just not that type of person. And I love to find out about how to do things properly, you know, really investigate. And one of the departments that I loved was the ceramics department because they really took you through every stage of making something, even the glazes and breaking down the chemicals and playing with the different colours that you can create. Different materials you could do, different textures. And that's how I kind of slipped into doing ceramics. So I came up to that stage. I came up to Belfast by myself. This was 1990. And did my degree in fine craft design and specialised in ceramics.
Wow.
And loved it.
Yeah, you know, that makes so much sense. Like, I feel like that's exactly how I felt. And I wish that my school had ceramics or something else, or like fibers, textiles, something, because I felt exactly the same way. I just didn't feel cool enough to be there, and I felt like I really wanted to learn. Same thing like as you. I like to know how to do things properly, and the school I went to was so conceptual that there was no teaching about how to paint or how to whatever, and the only class that was a real how-to was printmaking.
Right, yeah.
You know, same thing, because there were certain chemicals, or there was this, or there was a process that you had to follow. And I gleaned onto that, like I needed something. But it's so funny, because every time I talk to someone who ended up doing ceramics, it's very much like they're that kind of person, right? Where they want to understand something and know the process and follow that, and then allow your creativity to come into play, right?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult as well, being such a young person at stages, where you're expected to come up with a conceptual piece where you're still trying to find out who you are,
yeah.
Let alone decide what you're going to, you know, what your political opinion is on something and how you're going to express that in the media. It's like, I don't even know, you know, how I get here in the morning. I it's
know.
One of those things.
I always say, like, what was I supposed to paint about the fact that I was hungover from pub night the night before? Like,
yeah.
There was nothing. Like, so I know what you mean. That's amazing. And so with your ceramics, did you incorporate the fact that you can draw? Or no?
Well, the thing is, with ceramics, we had two great teachers, and they were both different, but both of them were telling us the importance of drawing in your sketchbooks is draw. Don't waste time trying to make something. Try and understand what it is you want to make first, then make it, because you'll answer all of your questions through understanding the depth and texture of things. So give me a really good three-dimensional sense of rendering something, because if I'm going to make it, I want to know how that texture is going to fit on the entire piece, or you know, rather than throwing a pot on a potter's wheel and making it 1 foot high. If I made it two foot high but slightly wider, but rather than trying to sit on the potter's wheel and do that, we would draw it out first and think, yeah, this one fits with what I want to do first, so I can now sit on the potter's wheel and rather than make 20 or 30 pots, make 10. And vary the difference between the profiles, etc., based on what I want rather than guessing as I'm trying to sit in the pot's wheel.
Right.
And along with that came textures and details and things like that you'd want to apply. Is what is it you want to do? So there was an awful lot of research that you'd have to do for your project, taking samples from lots of different sources. Looking at, you know, literally you would walk down the street and go, oh, that's the texture I need, and it'll be a crack in the pavement, and you'd be running up to the ceramics department to, you know, get a piece of plater so you could press it into the texture of the pavement to, you know, take that back to your sketchbook to draw it back out to figure out how you're going to then apply it to your piece. And it was as random and as nuts as that, but incredibly intuitive, and it was taught well because it allowed you the freedom to do that, but always asked you and prompted you to know why you were doing it as well.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just experimentation for the sake of it and randomly doing something. It's that you were working towards a refined answer to what your project was based on. So, drawing was a big part of the course.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you had to get on with making the ceramics as well, and learning every process that was involved as well.
Were you taking other like once you majored in that? Did you have to take other classes, or could you just solely do ceramics?
No, I could solely do ceramics. And
what was
nice is you could dip into different departments because you were doing ceramics. So you could say, like, I need say if you wanted a piece of lace to put a press into a texture, and rather than just going down the shop and getting a piece of lace, you could, you know, nip into the embroidery and textile department and say, listen, can you just show me how to make a bit of lace, you know, get some bobbins out? Or you could, you know, go into the sculpture department and say, right, I want to create this, but I want to need a frame for it. How can I make that? And so if you made friends with the technicians, they were the best source of information. Tutors, sadly, you know, their time was curtailed by course criteria and what they had to do, so you got very limited time with them. But the technicians were around working solidly all the time, so you could just grab hold of them and go, how do you do this? And bless them, they worked really hard.
Yeah, that's so cool. And good for you for going in there and like having the curiosity to go and do it.
Yeah, I think it was a kind of infectious thing on the course as well. Everybody was very, you know, was there to work.
Yeah.
And we were the ceramics department were the first ones in the morning and last ones out at night because we had to look after our kilns. So, you know, this is pre-computer days.
Yeah.
There was a few kilns there with simple programs you could use, but we'd have to literally go up to it and turn it up.
Yeah.
Every hour. You know, we had to babysit a kiln. So we couldn't escape, or we couldn't pretend not to come in because we were working at home, which we hear an awful lot of now.
Yeah.
It was literally, we just had to be there and work.
Well, and I've always heard that ceramics departments always have the best people. You always hear that. Even I was interviewing someone else who was a, what was she? I think a painting major. And she said, I used to just go and hang out in their ceramic studio because there was always someone there babysitting the kiln.
Yeah.
And, you know, just hanging out. And so there was always, like, you know, a cool group of people around. And so that probably helped with your transition into art school.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely did. Still lack of confidence. Still didn't really have a voice of my own. I think my confidence has developed over the last 9 years, to be honest with you.
Wow.
Before that, I would say I was fairly shaky on my art. I didn't know how to talk about it. Didn't know how to really express what I wanted or where I wanted to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, even leaving college, it was back in the early 90s, so there was a massive recession. Work in Northern Ireland was very difficult to come by. And I met my then, she's now my ex-wife, but my wife in college as well. And we decided we just needed to retrain, and computers were the latest thing. So we decided to go into that. And she did a master's in computers and design.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a year. And then when she came out, she got a job over in England. And so we moved back to, it was in Southampton. And the idea was for me to then go and do the same course, which we hadn't really thought this through, but it wasn't available in Southampton. So I decided to go and find work. And that's how I became a jewellery designer.
Yeah, I read that about you. And I was like, okay, yeah. How did that happen? How did you go from ceramics to jewellery designer?
And that's it. It's as simple
that's
as that.
How it
but
is.
What I realised was the design process itself fits right across the board.
Yeah.
And it can be any medium and anything, but the design process of gathering your information and gathering why you're doing something and refining the solution to it is the same process.
Right,
and
it's just the materials that are you have to learn
just,
the technique.
Yeah. And what was great there was we had a in-house goldsmiths and very, very talented chap used to work with Tim. And what he didn't know wasn't worth knowing. So I could create wonderful designs sitting with customers. I would phone up to Hatton Garden and get the gems down. It was a very exclusive shop, and it was a different world from which I was used to. And it definitely helped with my confidence in talking to people.
Mm.
You know, if you're designing a necklace that's worth £16,000, you've got to know what you're talking about, and you've got to be able to talk them through it as to why you've made certain design choices for them. And you can't get it wrong.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy that job. It really did sort of open me up a little bit.
How long did you do that for?
I did that for a couple of years, but then I kind of enjoyed the sales part of it as well. We used to sell Rolex and Cartier and Balmercier and the big watch brands and high-end jewellery. And I really did enjoy the sales, but it kind of led me into a path away from art for about 15 years, and I didn't pick up a pencil. And I got into retail management and worked for some large retailers here. And towards the end of it, I was miserable and I couldn't figure out why. Mm-hmm. And I think a large part of it was I wasn't feeding myself. I wasn't feeding myself creatively. And roughly about the same time, marriage broke up. And my partner's from Northern Ireland as well. So she'd come back here with my son. And I thought, I can't be in Luton by myself. We'd moved up to Essex and I'd then moved up to Luton. And I was working in London and I thought, this isn't it. I need to get back to doing what I love doing. And I was doing some little creative things. I was working on the side for myself, doing some garden design and landscaping.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had a small market garden here in Northern Ireland. And I decided to come back and I was going to be a garden designer. And this mm-hmm. was going to be my thing. And to teach myself, when I did eventually come back, give myself an extra few strings to my bow, I would learn stone carving and stone masonry so I could build dry stone walls and arches, etc. And there was a part of the course where the guy said, right, we're going to carve a piece of stone. And I got really, really excited. And he went, don't make it too complicated. And I came back in with, as a present for my dad, I did the, my surname's Boyd, so there's a Boyd family crest. It's an old Scottish name. And I came back with this crest and he went, oh, no, it's way too complex. I went, no, it's not. Let me at it. And he gave me the chisel and stones. And I had this, I just loved it. And I went, I'm a creative person.
Yeah.
And I need to follow this passion. I need to do this or something. And I was really lucky at that time. The ceramics tutor had left the college that I was learning my store medicine in. And I did some teaching there whilst I was a student. I used to travel up from Belfast to a place called Limmer Valley, which is right on the north coast of Northland, about 70 miles away. And the guy remembered me. He went, "You used to teach ceramics, didn't you?" And I went, yeah, I did. And he went, "Okay, we've got a vacancy. Apply for it." And I was lucky I got the job.
Wow.
So I started teaching. And I loved every minute of it. And it was teaching BTEC National Diplomas and Art Foundation and an associated degree. So it was the stages that people would then go off and go to different universities around.
Right.
But the up to associate degree level as well. So it was a real eye-opener, a real steep learning curve for teaching. But
yeah. Were you exhausted for the first little bit?
No, loved every minute
of
it.
Oh, that's so good.
I can honestly say my first day was, "There's your class. I'll see you at break time." And I was, right, okay, I'm now about to walk into a room full of 16 to 18-year-olds, and I need to know what I'm talking about. But thankfully, I was teaching ceramics, so I did. but it was to try to introduce it to people in a way that they could really enjoy or make sense for themselves, because I knew not every person in that room was wanting to be a ceramicist. There was people who were doing fashion design or people who were doing fine art or, you know, printmaking. So I always tried to make the ceramics suitable for what they were doing. So if they were doing, say, fashion design, I'd talk about, you know, different parts that they could use with ceramics to include with their dressmaking, what projects they were working on, etc.
So try to,
just kind of encourage them to use the material to its best ends for them, rather than saying, "This is what we're going to do. We're going to make a pot."
Yeah.
And, well, why do I want to make a pot? You know, it's got no relevance to me, and I'm just going to be wasting 2 weeks, and my mind's going to be somewhere else, and I'm not going to enjoy it. So rather than fight with them, I tried to work with them.
Wow.
Luckily enough, I worked in a place where that was encouraged, and we as a department kind of all worked together with the students and realised where people wanted to go relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. And rather than, because I think sometimes you can go through college and say, "Well, where do you see me best going?" And people are told to, you know, "You need to be a fine artist or you need to be a ceramicist." And it might not be the best choice for that person. They need to kind of step up and ask that question for themselves. What would I really like to do?
Mm-hmm.
And be encouraged that way.
That's a great flexibility. That's the sign of a very good teacher. I had a teacher that did that for me. She actually pulled me aside when I was doing my fine art degree and said, "I think you're a graphic designer."
Yeah.
And we didn't have graphic design at our school. I was like, what are you saying? Should I quit?" And she said, no, you know, "Get your BFA, but then I really think you need to go to design school because it's just in the way that you create." And I ended up being a graphic designer for 18 years and being very happy because it was right for me, you know. And I appreciated that so much that, you know, out of all the kids, all the students that were there, she actually really looked at us as people,
as individuals.
And saw who was standing in front of her and helped actually guide us. And I was going to ask, like, are you still in touch with any of those students?
Funnily enough, yes, I am. There's a couple there, a lady called Joni, and she's a musician as well. She plays drums. She was in a band in London there. And she's got, you should seriously look her up. I'll send you a link to her when we're done. And she does these amazing pen and ink pictures. And she's still creating.
That's awesome. And I bet she loved having you as a teacher.
Well, she was one of the mature students on the associate degree level course that we used to teach. And I used to take them for sculpture. And I used to get really excited going in there to see what they'd been up to. Because they used to feed me and also used to challenge me as well. Because I look at myself and go, "I need to really improve my skills. I need to step up here. Some of these kids and adults are pretty good."
Yeah.
And my skills are a little bit lacking. And I really looked at myself. And rather than letting that drain you, I let it feed me a little bit and got inspired by them and got excited. So when I left, I wanted to go back to my own work and make work, etc.
That's what I was going to ask. So you were teaching, but then, so what were you, if you hadn't picked up a pencil in a while, what were you now playing around with? Were you back to ceramics or were you drawing or what were you doing?
I was drawing and painting. And I was painting clouds for 2 years, just clouds, because I wanted to look at an abstract shape and colour, but with a sense of form that was based on something natural. And in where we were based up in Limavady, it has this massive sky, and there's very little in front of you and the Atlantic in some areas. And the sunsets are amazing, but where we were based in Limavady, across the mouth of the Foyle, you've got Donegal, and you could see the weather coming towards you. So you knew it was going to rain in about half an hour, so you had about half an hour to paint. So I painted these canvases for a couple of years, based purely just on cloud formations and colours, etc., and developed my skills that way. But I always knew that my drawing needed to develop as well.
Did you show anybody that work?
I did a little exhibition called Big Sky. And the title of that came from a conversation with a friend who's from Belfast. And I was going, so what are you doing? I was going, painting clouds. And she went, all right. She goes, what are you going to do with it? So I'm going to have an exhibition. She goes, oh, yeah. Well, what are you going to call it? And I went, well, Big Sky. And she just started laughing at me. She's going, what do you mean, Big Sky? The sky is big. I went, yeah, because in Belfast, because it's a city, you can only look up. Right. Directly straight up, and it's kind of in between all the buildings, etc. You don't get an idea of its expansiveness, and like it's just huge. And so we had this job, so that's the reason why it was called Big Sky, and it stayed that way.
And
it was fun. It was good learning curve. I had one little piece that was in a show over in New York. Around about this time, I started to network, and computers were just starting to develop the social media aspect, but I worked with Saatchi Art. Even back then, they had a chat room, and it was very early days. And a couple of us kind of got together, and from that, and would share opportunities and what was coming up, and exhibition callouts and things like that.
Mm.
And there was a 10x10 show, literally a small canvas, 10 inches by 10 inches, and you could do anything on it, and you contact a gallery and you send it to them. But we all decided, as many of us who got in, would turn up to that exhibition
in New York.
And yep. And I remember it got in. I was really excited because this is my first kind of step into the real world of being a proper artist, having work exhibited, etc. And I remember going, that's it, I'm gonna go, but I've got to get back to work, like on a Monday morning. So I literally left work on a Friday, jumped on a flight, flew to New York, went to the exhibition, crashed out in a hotel on a Sunday, didn't hardly sleep, and then got back on the plane, flew back to Northern Ireland. My dad picked me up in the airport and I went straight to work.
Oh my gosh.
On the Monday morning. But I was absolutely buzzing. I was really, really excited.
Well, yeah, you got to go.
Yeah, and I met the people I'd been chatting to, and from that little chat site that we had on Saatchi, we did other things as well. We did a thing called Art for Free, and we did it was organised by a lady from Slovenia, and she said, "Listen, we'll pull everybody together." It was a chap from London who did this one. Everybody arrive in front of the Hoxton Square Gallery in London, and there's a little tiny park. We can arrive there at this time. And we're going to give our work away to free to anybody who wants it. And it was amazing because what we were expecting was, it's just going to be a free-for-all. People are just going to be taking stuff off us, not really talking to us, and it's going to be done in a couple of minutes. And we'll be left with nothing, but we'll end up meeting everybody again, so that'll be fun. And what we realised was people were still really selective. And they wouldn't believe that it was for free, so they're going, yeah, but what's the catch? And going, nothing, if you like it, you can take it with you. And going, yeah, but am I going to have to pay for a ticket when I leave or something? I'm going, no, you can have it. What, really? And going, so I'm going, oh my God, how is this? Just take it. If you like it, take it. And you can see them kind of slowly, gingerly walking away from you, going, right, I'm about 10 feet away and I can really leg it if he asking for money for this point. But it was good. It was really good fun. And people were then engaged with us because we weren't trying to sell them something. They were engaged with who we were, what the artwork was about. They really loved it as well. But I brought a little ceramic piece over, and there's a little tiny marble plinth that I think used to be a water fountain, but it was broken, so it was just a marble plinth. And I set my piece up on that plinth, and nobody touched it for about 4 hours. People walked around it, and I was kind of stood beside it, not saying anything. And they would kind of peer at it and look at it and go, oh, yeah. And then walk away and go, oh, God. But they thought they would still have to buy that piece because that was a piece of ceramics.
You know, right, and it was on a pedestal.
And it was on a pedestal.
Yeah.
And eventually this lady came down and she put a hand on it and she was looking around her going, I'm going to get told off. I'm going to get told this is like £1,000 or £2,000. And I went, would you like it? And she went, can I have it? And I went, absolutely. And she, just that excitement as though this was hers. And there was other people stood around her going, oh,
damn.
I was like, yay.
You know, that is like a social experiment in the way that people handle galleries and art, like, you know, fine art in general. That's brilliant.
Absolutely. And we won't need to break the barriers because we've all realised that the art world's changing. It was even back then with social media, because we were connecting, we were realising that there's so much more we could do. The potential now is huge, it's massive. But back then it was just in its very, very early days of incubation. But we did that project again in Slovenia, where there was about, I think it was about 30 of us from 16 different countries.
Wow.
And it was amazing. It was sponsored by a building firm that was trying to regenerate the town. It was hosted by an arts group there. The arts centre that was in the town, they were really encouraging towards us. And we thought it'd be a language barrier, but it actually just became about smiles and nodding. And people pointing at things, going, like, can I take this? Yeah. Going, yeah. Thumbs up, yay, smiley face. And I got loads of photographs of these like random people just with little objects that I made and little figures I made out of papier-mâché and prints of the work and things.
Oh, it was so much fun. Gosh. And so was it sort of a same reaction that you had in England? Or was it, what was it like?
They were a little bit more open, I think. Where we're, in London, I think they were kind of guarded that we might be charging them for something and they were a bit more cautious.
Fair enough.
They were just coming to the town to do the shopping and suddenly in this square we were just going, do you want a piece of art? And they'd be like, oh, yeah, wait. And, yeah, it was so much fun.
Wow. What year was that?
Oh, God, that must have been, I'm thinking now, 2008, 2007, something like that.
Mm-hmm. What a brilliant idea.
Maybe earlier.
And are you in touch with that, those friends,
those
the Saatchi friends? Yeah.
Yeah, we're still on touch in Facebook and Instagram and things like that. Well, we're not as a group, you know, as a formalized group of people, but we're still very much in contact and they are genuinely, honestly lovely people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the key things is if you surround yourself with like-minded professional, forward-thinking people, it can really encourage you to do better yourself.
Yeah.
Not in a competition way, but you can see that if they put themselves out there and they try, and they might fail a couple of times, but the fact that they keep on putting themselves out there, that they get somewhere, that you can do the same thing, and they encourage you to try it, have a go, see what happens.
Mm-hmm. I sort of like what you were saying about when you were in school in ceramics, that, you know, the fact that the other students were popping into the textiles department or, you know, into the sculpture area, you know, like the fact that you were, and it was like, oh, okay, I can do that too, as opposed to feeling like you didn't have the right.
Yeah, and I think what I've realized is if you're waiting for somebody to tell you it's okay, you'll be waiting a long time.
Yeah.
you know, if you wait for somebody to discover you, you'd be waiting a long time. That fantasy kind of romanticized notion of you someday somebody will discover you.
Someday your prince will come.
Yeah, it doesn't really work like that. No. You've really got to do an awful lot of work for very little gain to begin with. And it's a good training ground, but you learn from it, and because you're constantly producing something and constantly believing in what you're doing or refining it and developing as an artist, because that's non-stop, that's ongoing forever. People then see your work. You know, they might be watching for a couple of years going, yeah, he's good, but we'll see what he's doing in 2 years' time and think, okay, he's still doing it and he's got better, so we'll give him a shout and see what he's up to. We'll give him a challenge or we'll get him included. Or that's what happened. And then similarly with, I moved from Limmer Valley to Bangor and I didn't know anybody. And I know there's lots of artists in and around the area, because I talked to people in the sort of the art shops and things like that, where I got my pens and pencils from. And I said, yeah, there's loads. I'm going, but where are they? I can't find them. Expecting there to be like one place where they all congregate. A little bit stupid and a little bit naive. But I remember going up to see the arts officer in the Bangor Council, being very supportive, Patricia. And I kind of walked in there and she thought I was being really arrogant, but I wasn't. I was just frustrated. And I went in and said, right, you're the arts officer. What's happening? And she thought I was going, right, you're the arts officer. So what are you doing?
Yeah.
And she kind of picked me up wrong to begin with. And then when I was kind of, sort of explained myself, going, no, I'm just really desperate to find out where the other artists are hanging out. And then she found out I did ceramics. And then she told me that she did exactly the same course a couple of years after me.
Oh.
And she'd also done ceramics, so she knew my tutors. And then that kind of broke the ice. And then she said, well, listen, a few people have contacted me with the same issue about how do we get you together. So they put a call out for artists in the area. And I think it was about 15 of us turned up.
And wow.
We just had a little chat. And then there's a few of us there. And a lady called Inga and her husband were there. And she said, listen, we'll start a Facebook group up and I'll give it a name and we'll join there. And we can meet up once or twice a week or once or twice a month just to get out of the studio and sort of have a chinwag. It's so nice to meet other creative people. And so the following week, there was 8 of us. And then 2 weeks after that, there was 22.
Oh.
And this thing just grew. And now there's on a Facebook group that we have, and it's for artists in Ireland, North and South, and further afield, if they want to join. There's 677 of us now that are in the Belfast, in the one we started. And there was a North Coast firstie that started up. I think it's got about 200 people in it. So it was just a network
Wow.
of artists. But the wealth of knowledge is huge. And some of those artists are really good. And so where you might be sitting by yourself in a studio trying to find out how the hell are you going to get a piece of artwork to, I don't know, Australia, and you've got to get a courier, but you don't know who's a good courier, you can just ask a question on the Facebook page and there'll be somebody else there going, yeah, I've sent loads of work, use this guy.
Wow.
And it saves you so much time and effort.
Yeah, and you feel it, and you realize you're not alone.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
You're not alone. There's other people going through the same dilemmas. And I know from your books as well, you have that self-doubt. How do you get yourself out of a block? How do you negotiate some of the problems you're having with a picture or a painting, things aren't working properly? So what we found was that people naturally gravitated towards each other in certain areas. So it was able to have group exhibitions to build up your portfolio of an experience. You know, you'd be working with other people who might be working in graphite or pencil.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you were a painter, other painters working in the same genre or medium or, you know, subject matter. And from that, we start to notice that people were using this as a database as well, where the local council would want to run an arts project. They would put a call out and they would be sending us the information to put on our page. So they would go out and then everybody got a chance to have a go at it. So the community of artists in and around Northern Ireland is massive. And the talent here is phenomenal. It's just, we're just starting to sing out a little bit about what we do.
Mm-hmm. That's so great. So exciting.
It is exciting. And the potential here is massive. Although, even though it's economically difficult at the minute, you know, the whole thing about Brexit has kind of thrown spanners in the works with how you get your work across to Europe when it's at the border.
Mm.
And you can always look for the negatives, but you can also share out some of the information with each other. And that's one of the things I've strive to do, is to continue research, sort of a good working practice, So I looked at people in the States and the artists I loved, and I looked at how they were talking about their work and how they were networking with other artists and how they were talking to each other. And I really admired their easy professionalism, because it made it easy for a general public to start to love what they did and to contact them and to talk to them one-to-one. So where we back in the day may have thought, oh, artists are very stroppy, flaky type people who kind of don't do very much or fall asleep in the afternoon. These guys are working phenomenally hard all the time, but producing beautiful work. And that's the kind of work ethic that I've kind of tried to give myself.
Yeah, you sure have.
Own out with other people.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, and I think there's that nice thing about accessibility, too. Like, I think that's something really nice that social media has done, is made people realize, like, you can reach out to an artist if you love their work.
Yeah.
And they're just a person, you know, who also has a mortgage and also has to go pick up groceries. And it's not this wall of, well, they're a fine artist and you can't, you know, it's almost like touching your ceramic piece on that pedestal in the park, right? It's like, you can reach out, you can chat, you can
And we want to hear from people.
Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely want to hear from people. Want to have that conversation with people, because you can live in a bubble with your artwork.
Yeah.
And you know what it's about, but you want to know how it's communicating and connecting with people. And, you know, what was great, we had a project here along the seafront called Project 24. And it was it's an interim project while they're trying to develop the seafront in the town.
Okay.
And they've got shipping containers, which they redesigned into studios for artists.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
It is. It is a phenomenal. It's a jewel in the crown of an idea. And not many people know about it. We are awful at really marketing ourselves and telling people about what we've got here. But it's a fantastic project. I did it for 2.5 years, and it's still going on now whilst trying to figure out sort of planning permission for the All Singing, All Dancing new development for the seafront. But the projects, the studios are still there, but it was open to the general public. So artists would be just in there working, and they could work there. You could work, be in there 24 hours a day if you wanted to be. But the people in the general public would be coming down to the seafront to have their ice cream and their fish and chips and look at the boats and walk along the seafront, would be walking past your window going, what's that about? Who's in there? Look at him sitting there. I've got a terrible habit of when I think, I look like I'm dead. Right. So I'd be like, look at him sitting there doing nothing, but I could hear him. And my first 2 weeks, because he's got this massive window, and you're a bit like an animal in a zoo.
Yeah.
Where they're just kind of looking at you going, what's he up to?
And nobody threw peanuts at you, did they?
No.
No, that's good. Thank
you. We did hear the comments, and the comments were great because they were really what people thought. They were no holds barred. And I love the honesty of the people in Northern Ireland. They will just tell you, you know, what they think. And I heard comments of going, what's that £1,000 for that picture? He must be nuts. That's like my mortgage for 2 months. What the hell is he thinking? Bloody hell, I wouldn't pay that, and he'd walk away. And then somebody, you know, would go, I've walked past your pod for the last 6 months. I absolutely love this picture. It's been driving me mad. I know exactly where I'm going to put it. Can I buy it, please? And there'd be no way of me contacting that person to engage them with the work if they hadn't seen it in that format. So
right.
It made me realise it gave me a thicker skin to appreciate people's perceptions of the work. Some people are upset, some people loved it. And I didn't mind a negative comment as long as they weren't being rude.
Right.
you know, if they're going, I don't understand why you've done that, it kind of upsets me. And I go, well, why does it upset you? And we talk about because it was to be the Manimal thing.
So I was just going to ask if it was the Manimal series.
Yeah, it did kind of upset them. Because it's all a form of portraiture. Well, it kind of unnerves them. It's got this, I try to make them as real as possible.
Yeah, you sure do.
Looking at that animal head really does fit on that body. You know, it's not just stuck on. It's a part of the whole scene that it actually feels like it's in that space. So it would unnerve them. I did have one lady. There's a picture called The Guardian, and it's actually my cat, Sophie, in this cowl, but it's based on somebody I know who watches over them. Well, not just me, but other friends as well. Always on the lookout for, are you okay, that type of thing. And I wanted to do this picture based on that. And this cat-headed figure in this white lace cowl, and it's in a dark sort of alleyway. It's very, very dark in the background. And she went, I can't even look at that picture. And I went, oh, right. She even had her hand up beside her face to sort of shield her eyes from that. She did. After looking at it. I went, if you don't mind me asking, it's an amazingly strong reaction. I don't mind that you don't like it. And she went, no, it's not that. She goes, can you remember there was a cartoon called Dogtanyan? I went, yeah. And this was a cartoon when I was back in the 80s. And it was a cartoon version of Three Musketeers, but they were all dogs.
Oh, okay.
And Cardinal Richelieu had this spy who was this cat. And this cat wore this cowl. And when she started to tell me about it, I went, oh, right, I wonder if subliminally I remembered this and I put this into this picture. And she goes, well, that cat gave me nightmares as a child and I still have them. And that's why I can't look at that cat. And I went, oh, right, okay. So that's amazing. I said, listen, I'm sorry I upset you, but obviously I wouldn't have known.
Yeah.
I would have done that too. But it's interesting still to hear those reactions.
Well, and that's kind of fantastic that something that you made can have that kind of a reaction.
Yeah.
You know,
it's had positive ones as well.
Yeah.
People are intrigued by it, a bit lost, but then go to explain to them that we're actually used to this form of artwork without knowing it. It's in our language. You know, we'll say he's a sly old fox, or he's a cheeky monkey, or the bitch word. You know, all of these animal kind of animalistic things can be used as a derogatory term as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also in our culture where we've George Orwell, Animal Farm.
Yeah.
Even if you think about Enid Blyton or Mickey Mouse from Disney. But if you look back into the cultural references, we've got Native American Indians would have used the animal as a story narrative to tell you different aspects. It's on their medicine wheel, you know, different points of the medicine wheel was associated with an animal. Greek and Roman gods used to come down to earth as animals. Their attributes would have certain linkages with their deity. So the god of Mars was war. His animal that he would come down to earth as would be a wild boar.
Hmm.
And we get the idea of that's where we may have got the idea for the male chauvinist pig. Because pigs aren't male chauvinist.
Right.
They're just pigs. Why do we associate poor little pig? But I did a picture called For God's Sake, No Means No, with a really ugly pig-headed bloke stood there with a bottle of beer, and at the far end of the bar is a lady with a swan, and the goddess Venus, the idea of love, his idea of love, her animal attribute was a swan. So I've got this pig and the swan stood in the bar, which is a very modern scene, but it's based loosely, very loosely, on the idea of these Greek and Roman gods meeting up in the bar. And he's trying to chat her up, and she's just going, go away.
Yeah.
In the nicest possible terms.
And where do your ideas come from? Do you just have like little flashes of these things that you sketch down, or?
Sometimes. Sometimes I just write sentences down, or I hear a sentence in a bar, or, you know, in a coffee shop somewhere, or just walking down the street, or I see something and I write what I see down, and then it helps me remember it visually.
Yeah.
So I've got one that says she held onto a storm in a teacup, but she held onto it like there was a storm going on actually in her teacup. And I was remember sitting in the coffee shop watching this woman, and she looked really pissed off. And she was looking into a teacup and gripping hold of it like somebody had stood her up or something had happened. And I don't want to intrude. It's just my perception of these things. It's more why I kind of allegorically see. And then that'll kind of ferment in my head. So in the back of my head, I've got millions of artworks that I want to create. So when I do one, it's like expunging it. It's like, thank God that's out.
Yeah.
Now I can get on with the rest of them.
It must take a long time to get it out.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes it feels like it's drawing itself and it's falling off of the pencil.
Yeah.
And I'm just holding on to it for dear life. And it's finished. And I love it when that happens, but it's a very rare scenario. And then there's other ones where I really have to think and construct the whole composition, and I have to look at the different materials, I have to look to get the space right and the lighting right, and because I'm trying to draw it in such a realistic way that it looks natural but feels like you know it but you don't understand it quite, you know, it creates a slight uneasiness. And sometimes I do that purposefully, not to be manipulative, but I want to create a narrative that people engage with. So they're like a ones, because I love film, Yeah, these are like a one snapshot film.
They are. They're like movie stills. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, when you see people, I just have to ask this because I've been thinking this for the last few minutes. When you meet people, do you think cat, rabbit?
Yeah, sometimes no. I got asked that question and people thought I actually saw people with animal heads on. I went, no, I'm not mad. I'm not on drugs. I don't walk down the street going, there's a giraffe following me and run away. But sometimes you're having a conversation with people and it's not necessarily what they physically look like.
Yeah.
There'll be elements to their personality, I think, which sing more about their animal. Their inner animal, if you like.
What animal would you be?
There's a lot of psychology. I've been several. So the one I've got on my Skype thing at the minute is that black rabbit.
Yeah.
That's the one that we've got onto the TV show, The Show Me the Money.
Oh, that's coming up on my questions.
We'll talk about him in a second. What else have I been? I've been a horse. I'm a Peruvian horse. Mm-hmm. Type. What else have I been? I've been an aye-aye, which is this weird little creature from Madagascar. Yes. Which is the ugliest thing in the world, but it's so cute.
Ugly, cute.
Yeah. And so misunderstood.
And they have those weird fingers.
Yeah, really long fingers.
Yeah.
And they were hunted to virtual extinction because it was thought that if they pointed at you, you were going to die. So people would go out and intentionally kill them so they wouldn't be pointed at.
No.
That stopped, I think. And they're trying to protect them as a species. And I think Stephen Fry talked about them. And that brought them to everybody's attention. And there's like... They are such weird little looking things. You know,
wouldn't you want to have a little pet one, though?
Yeah, I've got a mad cat called Sophie. she's like a ninja. So I'd probably attack it. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, it's really funny because my husband has really big hands. And he always, my son was obsessed with any kind of animal when he was little. So we somehow discovered eyes. And so Greg will sometimes like... poke his finger at me and say aye, and it creeps me out, and so it's just so funny. I'll have to tell him about the pointing thing, that you know, he better watch or he'll be hunted to extinction.
And Madagascar is such a weird little place as well, because all of these animals grew different naturally over the years, developed to survive in their natural habitat, and they use their fingers to get bugs out of deep holes in trees and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so long and black. And they survive at night time. They're quite nocturnal.
Do you have an eye piece in your portfolio then?
Yes, I do. I don't show it because it's a naked piece.
Oh.
And it's a self-portrait.
Okay, well then I'll just put in a photo of an actual eye. We'll leave that one. Leave that one to everyone's imagination.
Yeah, because you really wouldn't want that out there.
I'd get kicked off Facebook probably. I've got two strikes on Facebook. Apparently.
Oh.
Yeah, from posting art with a dreaded nipple or something every now and then. Geez. And so if I do one more, I've been told my page will be taken away. So a naked eye might do it. I really wish,
and that would be my hope, that Facebook get a handle on art and realize that nobody is out there to pervert people's minds.
No.
It's just the human body. It's just like anything else. Just like an elbow or a nose.
We've all got it.
Part of the physical body. Yeah. And these are paintings. These are works of art. They're saying something. If you don't like them, click onto the next person.
Exactly.
Don't click, record.
Report.
Report or whatever.
It drives me nuts. Okay. I've had you on here for so long, but I want to hear about this.
It's fine.
Show Me the Money.
Yeah, cheesy title, isn't it?
I love it. I didn't get it at first, and then I was like, okay, now I get it.
He spelled that wrong.
Yeah.
This came from a friend, Katie Sullivan. She's a great portrait artist, and again, somebody to really look at. I just remember having a conversation on, I think it was a Facebook chat we were having, and she said, look, apply for this. And this was back in about 2009, just when sort of I was getting back into my artwork, and it was when... I just really started doing the Manimal series as well. One of these things, everything came together at the right time. She said, listen, apply for it. It's by the BBC. If it gets onto the TV show, it's really going to show people your work. And you'll learn. What have you got to lose? And I couldn't answer that question. I went, I can't really lose anything. If you don't get on, you don't get on.
Right.
So I applied and I got a phone call to say, can you tell us about your work and what it is? And I did that and said, okay, we'll give you a call back. And they did and said, right, we want you to come over to Scotland and meet the production people because they'll interview here. And Katie had also applied as well, and she'd gone, and a few other people we knew had, they'd all gone. So we'd all got to the same sort of stage. So we'd all gone off, because this was the whole UK, so it was regional. So people in Northern Ireland had to go to Scotland, people down south went to London, people in the north went to sort of Manchester or Bristol, whatever. So we're all in different locations, and they said, yeah, we love it. We're going to keep your work here. And so the next time you're going to come back, you'll be actually on the show. And you had to sit in front of a panel of judges, a bit like the X Factor.
Yeah.
Do you get the X Factor there? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there were people, there's a lady called Charlotte Mullings who's written some brilliant books about portraiture. And I thought, if I get my work in front of her, she's going to see it and she's going to give me feedback. So if I don't get on to the exhibition at the end of it all, I don't mind too much. I'm going to hear some really good, clear feedback from professionals. You know, the type of feedback that you just can't get from where I'm living. And I remember being really relaxed on the day, arriving really early in the morning, and so much so that I was supposed to arrive in the afternoon, but my flight was early, so I was just saying, listen, can I just hang around? And I went, actually, can you come in first? Because there's somebody who's going to be late. So I remember sitting in the green room looking around me, and there's a few people had, like, what they did and who they were written down on cards, and they were trying to memorise it. And I'm going, you should know who you are. And like, you should. But this is what I'm thinking, this. I didn't say it. And I'm going, you're right. And they're going, yeah. And they sat there with a cup of tea, and they said, right, we're just going to do some tracking shots and move past you and film you this way and do that. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'm still trying to drink a cup of tea. So I was really relaxed for some reason. And I remember standing outside then the door, and they said, listen, this is what we're going to do. Because if TV's a bit sort of controlled that way, this is what we're going to do. You'll hear, come in, you will walk up to your easel, your artwork will be there, panel judges will be sat in front of you, nobody will say anything for about a minute. And what we're going to do is film different shots, etc. And then one of them introduce themselves, and they'll ask you to talk about your work. You talk about your work for a minute, and then the judges will critique you.
Oh, my God.
Not a problem. This is fine. I knew what my work was about.
Yeah.
And they said, I could hear, like, come in. And I got to the door handle, and it wouldn't open. And I'm going, by pulling it. And then I'm going, I'll give it a shove on my shoulder. And I burst through the door because it was a push, not a pull. And I was suppressing a laugh. My face had gone bright red. And I just smiled, walked up to the easel and kind of just stood there. I went, oh, geez, I'll really top this up. And you could see them going, oh, what an idiot. You know, the only one thing you had to do was walk through the door, and you can't even do that. Jesus Christ, bet it's going to be a load of crap. And I'm just thinking, oh, well, doesn't matter, not gone in. So it kind of made me even relax even more. Rather than panic about it, I just went, just go with the flow. And I started talking about the work and explaining it. And it's a self-portrait. The Black Rabbit is a self-portrait. And the background of it is IKEA shops, because I used to work for IKEA as well. I remember saying we used to work in retail.
Yeah.
And there's a piece of ceramics that my tutor had done, and a small pot that I'd made. And the rest of it is bare, because I thought, that is where I'm at right now. Everything is open and bare, and I only have this very kind of sparse art background of who I am, but I know where I want to be. And I've got this thing about the rabbits are an amazing creature, that they're incredibly aware of everything. And I think it's very similar to artists. I mean, massive ears, big eyes, they're watching everything, but they're incredibly quiet. They're just taking it all in. So I based it on this black rabbit. And I was talking about it and explaining it for a minute, and then I shut up. And then they started to talk about my work and ask me questions and things. And then the production crew said, right, stop it there. Lee, can you just do us a favour? And I'm going, yeah. Can you say what each of those judges would be as an animal? And I thought, oh dear, I can get myself into really serious trouble here. And I started to explain, so there's three judges there, and I started to explain, you know, why this person was an owl and why this person was a lemur. And then I looked at Charlotte Mullins, and she's a very graceful person, but she knows what she's doing, but she's almost quite serene. And I went, you're a bit like a duck. As soon as it came out of my mouth, I went, oh, wrong answer, just wrong. And she goes, well, what do you mean by that? I was like, well, kind of like you have this veneer of gliding across the surface, but I know you work incredibly hard underneath, and I can just see your legs paddling away. I know there's so much firing up on behind your eyes, but to look at you, you sit and give away nothing. And then I went, I should have said a swan. Like, and started laughing. And she went, yes, well, maybe you should have been. I remember them sort of saying, when it came out on TV, I remember the narrator going, oh, you can see Lee's incredibly nervous. And it wasn't. That was the point of me being bright red.
Crashing through the door.
Trying not to laugh. Yeah. So I know TV's a bit weird. But that did get chosen.
Yeah, and so you were in the final exhibition then?
It did, yeah, final exhibition, and it sold. It was a blind bid, so we had no idea who bought it. And I still didn't know who bought it. We weren't allowed to ask and find out until about a year later, and I have a friend in New Zealand, and she went, oh, your artwork's in the local House and Garden magazine. And I went, what are you talking about? And I mean, sometimes people think it's my artwork because it's an animal head on a person.
Right.
And there's lots of artists working in that genre, some really good ones as well. I said, oh, have you got a picture of it? And she showed it to me. I went, God, that is my picture. And it's above a chopping board. Who's this? And I found out it was Peter Gordon. He's a celebrity chef. And he bought it. And it was sitting in his London home.
Wow.
His kitchen. I thought, what a great place for it to find a home. And I had no idea.
That's so cool.
And there's been other little things like that that's happened. With Saatchi, have been an amazing resource for me. And I can't thank them enough. They have...
Me too.
brilliant. They are amazing. And I would always encourage people to get their work on there because so many more people see it, like Instagram,
yeah,
that wouldn't get to normally see it if you just have it in your hometown.
Mm-hmm. And they do such a good job promoting people too. And
they do.
Yeah.
They do. And I've been one of their ones to watch. And they put they have guest curators coming in. I don't know, you've done a guest curation
there as well. Yeah, I've done one, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they had Carly Rae Jepsen. Do guest curation, and she chose one of my artworks to link with one of her songs.
Oh.
And she called it The Perfect Dark Fairy Tale. And I went, I couldn't write a better tagline for what that particular piece was about. And she'd chosen it to link up with one of her songs on a new album. And that was part of her curation. So I think that's still up there on the site that you can check out.
Wow, that's very cool.
But that brought a whole new audience to look at the work. And I do... I've done an album cover for a local band here and for a few other musicians here. And it just spreads the artwork out into different locations and people get to engage with it differently.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beer company in Canada, Creative Brewing Company, and they put a call out every year for people to send in their artwork that they put on then on beer labels.
Yeah.
And then they link the beer labels with a scanning code that it can scan. It'll tell you about the artist and the artwork. But they also link it with a band and music, etc.
Wow.
With one of their crafted beers.
Yeah.
So one of my pictures, She Has Pride, was used for that. So it's just, I like the fact that artwork now is not just solely in a gallery on a wall.
Exactly.
It can be anything and anywhere. I'm working on a whole new range of work at the minute.
I was going to ask you what is happening next.
Yeah. It's still got an animal feel to it, but I really... It's all a form of portraiture. I'm always telling a story about somebody or some scenario with people in it. And what I really decided was it's really hard to capture one likeness of one person and tell a whole story about them because you're capturing them at a specific moment in their life or in their day or whatever. So I've decided to base it on people that I know and mean something to me and that I base it on the conversation that we have. So... over the last few months, I've been having these one-to-one conversations and recording them by writing down all what comes up through it. I don't have a plan about what the conversation's going to be about. I don't have a structure to them. We just start talking because they're friends. I don't have to kind of interview them in the same format. But out of it, I've got some great ideas for these portraits. So I've always said, look, I'm going to take some reference shots and... You might be sort of sat in your front room, or I get them to choose where we meet and at what time, and they can wear what they want. The only thing I ask them is to choose their own animal.
Oh.
And that animal will appear in the picture. and I get them to explain why they've chosen it for themselves. And they have been so creative and so engaged with the project that the ideas are amazing. And then out of the conversation, etc. So I'm trying to give a whole picture of what this person's about. So they might be slightly sort of surreal in some aspects, and they might be very realistic in others.
Have you started? Are you still gathering information, or have you started drawing?
I've done some of the portrait. Every person I've met so far, when I have the conversation, I do a pencil portrait of them, and they're all on my Instagram page.
Okay.
And I've done a quick montage video that morphs all the faces together, which is quite a fun thing. I found an app, and I thought, oh, I wonder what this would work. So it morphs all the faces and noses and eyes, so the faces shift to one to another. I think there was a Godly and Cream video that I remember.
It's so creepy but cool.
Yeah, so I've done my partner Andrea, and I've done my son Ethan and Andrea's son Callan. I've done my friends, my close friends, and people I've known since this sort of last 9 years.
Wow.
So it's going to be around about 25 portraits in total, and I haven't decided. Well, each picture is individual, so it will tell a narrative story of its own.
Right.
And the each one will dictate itself whether it's going to be in pencil or painting or in what medium, itself. So, and then to have the exhibition at the end.
That is so exciting. I can't wait to see it. I'll just spy on you through Instagram until I can see it. Well, that is awesome. Oh, Lee, this has been so good. Okay, but now, of course, it's the not so speedy speed round.
One of the things I've been looking forward to. I have listened to all of your podcasts. They are sort of like accompaniments to my drawing.
Oh, really? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. That and movies and play music. I would just play a podcast and I kind of listen to it going, I've been there too. And that's happened to me.
I know. There's lots of things that you said today that have given me chills, that I know that people are in their studios listening and are going to be tearing up or laughing or getting chills too, because it's, we're all in it together.
Yeah, we've all done it.
Yep.
We're all there.
Okay, not so speedy speed round. I already think I know this by something you've said zillions of times. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Oh, because you've said a cup of tea a bunch of times.
Well,
to have a cup of tea in Ireland.
Well, yeah. Well, this is one of the things. Everybody has tea here, and I'm not. I'm a coffee addict, and I'm even having to stop myself from drinking so much because it's not that great for you when you drink 20-odd cups a day. But yeah, I'm a coffee person. Definitely.
Me too. Okay, my son wanted me to ask this.
Okay.
At any point in your childhood, were you in Ireland in your childhood? Or in
coming
England?
Up to visit my relations, I was, yeah.
Okay. So at any point in your childhood, did you search for a leprechaun?
Yes, normally at the end of a rainbow so I could find the pot of gold.
Right. It's really all about the gold.
I just went for the money.
Yeah. My son was obsessed with them when he was little. They would set leprechaun traps around St. Patrick's Day with like anything green. He'd put out peas and he would like raid the cupboard for anything that was green, and they would put it in these little boxes out in the yard and just wait for a leprechaun. And like, we're in Western Canada. So I was like, do Irish kids look for leprechauns?
Yeah, they probably came over with the settlers and...
That's right.
Yeah.
They stowed away on some boat, I'm sure.
Yeah, they did. Your son asked the best question, by the way. I know in different podcasts he goes, my son just wants to know. I'm going, yeah, this is great.
I know. He has the best questions. And all of his would you rathers are always so good. Okay, so this will be hard to answer probably, but favorite animal?
Oh, God. Can't.
No, too many. Rabbits, cats,
there's just
ducks.
I mean, I love my cat, but I love dogs as well. I love the individual animals that we have. I love their personalities, not because they're a cat.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yep, totally. Okay, and then the last one. Best or worst summer job you ever had?
I'm always working.
When you were a teenager, did you have jobs?
Oh, teenager, yeah. Oh, well, yeah, I did. When I was in uni, I worked as a bouncer in the Students' Union, which I was crap at. I really wasn't very good. I should just let everybody in.
That's a great bouncer. I would have loved you.
Yeah, I always seemed to have a queue of people for some reason, and that's probably why. I was a cleaner in. Since I was stupid, I am sometimes. I was a cleaner in a rehabilitation centre for people who were blind. This is whilst I was a student. It was a large house, so they had a large kitchen, and they would teach people how to cook, etc., when they were dealing with coming to terms with being blind and how they could do things. And it was a resource place as well that had offices up above. And I had to go and clean this place every day. And I kept being left these notes saying, please clean all the rooms. Please empty all of the bins, with underlined. I'm going, I'm emptying all the bins. They're being really rude. And then it was a couple of weeks down the line, and then one of my supervisors came in and said, Lee, you're not cleaning all the rooms. I'm going like, I don't know what's going on here. I clean everything. I empty all the bins, etc. And she goes, well, walk me around the house. And so I walked around the house, and she went, have you been down here? And I went, that's the back door, isn't it? And she went, no. And she opened this door, and there was a whole other part of the building that I'd never cleaned. And I'd been doing it for a couple of months. And this was... And once I found out, they were like, oh, right, okay. But I wouldn't say a bad job. It was because they were lovely, because they used to leave me out cookies and biscuits that they'd made during the day as well.
So, emptying all the bins, then they would leave you things.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, now this kid's doing his job.
Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you what, this wasn't a job, but speaking of being a bouncer, when I was in university, because I was the art kid in residence, and there weren't that many art students that lived in res, everybody would come to my door on Thursday at around dinner, because that Thursday was pub night, and I would use my markers and draw on a distressed-looking entry stamp on people's hands so that it looked like they'd already been in and out, so then you were allowed back in if you had the stamp.
Yeah.
Instead of having to wait in the line. And so we would figure out which stamp it was that day. I don't know how we knew that, but somehow we would find it out. And then I would, you know, and I'd smudge it and make it look like it had been on their hand, but maybe washed off a little bit. And that's what I would do for like an hour before the pub night, was draw stamps on people's hands. So you know what? The BFA went to good use.
Yes, was it? It became a functional thing.
That's right. I should have charged. I didn't charge anything.
I might even still do that now.
You know what? That's right. I'll go hang out at the residence at universities and, hey, kids.
I heard a thing about if you lick them straight away and stuck it onto somebody else's hand, it would leave an imprint of the exact thing.
Yes, so but then it's in reverse, and they would check for that.
If you do, yeah.
Yeah, you know, these are the things you need to really think through when you're developing a business plan where you don't charge people anything.
It's true.
That's it. That's all my questions.
All right, okay. This has been an absolute pleasure, and thank you so much again.
It was so fun. I just loved it. And now, I always say this, but now I have a great excuse to go and gather up black rabbits and all the stuff and put a big giant post on my site, and I get to show off my Venice panther piece again, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this. I loved every minute.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. You made it very, very easy as well.
My pleasure. And I will go and spy on Instagram and see how these portraits turn out.
Cool.
Okay.
Please do.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye.
You too. Take care.
What a lovely guy. I always try and think of my favorite bits to talk about in the outro, but there might have been too many. I did really love the story about the bit of green pencil still lodged in his knee. Oh, and the part where he told the judge on Show Me the Monet that she was a bit like a duck. Hilarious. Anyway, thank you so much to Lee for sharing all of his fantastic stories and wonderful advice. Thank you to Saatchi Art for not only supporting the episode, but for also supporting amazing artists all over the world, just like Lee. And as always, thank you to you for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.